The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh.
Hello.
Ohio Gazimas, if you can hear me.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me? I hear you.
So we don't hear you. We hear nothing, so. Strange.
Can you hear me now?
Now we hear you.
Oh, you can hear me finally.
That was our problem, I'm sorry.
Okay. Ohayou gozaimasu. My limited Japanese. So, how is the weather over there in Japan this morning?
Not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's sunny.
Yeah, it's a bit chilly, but yeah, it's spring, so weather is getting better and better.
Yeah, we're kind of on the border here, too. We had some very nice daytimes, and then nighttime it gets very cold, so can't make up its mind. All right, so if you guys are ready, I guess we'll try to get started here.
Okay, we are ready.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, Dr. McCannibal and Mirai Kawashima of the legendary Psy on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. We present the most interesting couple in metal, with the career reaching back as far as 1990, and with their first album gaining worldwide attention as both one of the first acts and one of the few records ever released under Euronymous's Death Like Silence label. This man has been at the forefront of the black metal scene. As the first and most prominent of Japanese extreme metal bands, he and his bandmates pursued a musical path marked by an unusual diversity and determinedly unique sound, as synchronous and genre bending as the late Frank Zappa. After an amazing 8-album run, this man met a woman of equal talent whose intellectual acumen and natural beauty are bolstered by an unusual predilection towards underground death metal vocalization and a soulful saxophone style, and her arrival marked yet another sea change in the band's direction. Please join us as we speak to the multi-talented Mirai Kawashima and the lovely Dr. McCannibal of progressive black metal maestro Psy, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, a brief message. The hardest thing I've had to do for this show was to narrow it down to a mere 5 favorites to use. This is a band I truly love to hear, whose pure musicianship and experimentalism crosses numerous genres all at once, from black metal, traditional, to classical, and jazz and fusion. The only band I've ever heard outside of Psy to stretch this much and succeed so well at what they're trying to do is that of the late Frank Zappa, of whom I've been known to refer to as my second father musically. With a long career spanning back to the early 90s and a good 10 albums worth of material, trying to pull what amounts to less than one song per album was extremely difficult and resulted in my use of some fairly personal and idiosyncratic choices, leaning more heavily towards their most recent material, which shows them at their most accomplished. If you find yourself similarly fascinated and appreciative of their efforts herein, I cannot encourage you enough to seek out pretty much their entire back catalog. You will not be disappointed. And with that said, we proudly present one of my favorite bands, the legendary Psy. In our first segment, we talked Metaphysics, Death Like Silence and Cacophonous, and Killjoy and the whole Gallows Gallery mess. But before we get into that, here's a wild and challenging track off the Scenes of Hell album featuring Mika and Mirai trading off vocals. This is Prelude to the Oracle.
Yeah.
tonight we're talking metal, and we have with us the most interesting couple on the extreme metal scene today and possibly ever, with a career stretching all the way back to 1990, and with their first album gaining worldwide attention as one of the first acts and one of the few records released under Euronymous' Death Like Silence label. This band has been at the forefront of the black metal scene from a time when its only known bastions were Norway, Sweden, and possibly Brazil. As the first and most prominent of Japanese black metal bands, his band has steadfastly refused this and all other labels, and pursued a musical path marked by an unusual diversity and determinedly unique sound, as syncretist and genre-bending as the late Frank Zappa, but in the general ballpark of underground, extreme, and specifically black metal. After an amazing 8-album run, this man met or discovered a woman of equal talent, whose intellectual acumen and natural beauty are bolstered by an unusual predilection towards underground death metal vocalization and a soulful saxophone style, and her arrivals mark yet another sea change in the band and its direction. With much pride, I bring you Mariah Kawashima and Dr. McCannibal herself, the future Mika Kawashima. Mika, Mariah, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi.
So allow me to preface all this by saying that spending a day or two pouring through the Sideback catalog is something else. It's like being transported to another world. You've got an amazingly unique sound.
Yeah, thank you very much.
In a world of sound alikes, there's really no single band or genre I can compare you to or pigeonhole as an influence. So let's go back to the beginning. Mariah, you, Shinichi, and Satoshi at least started out as, and to some extent still fall under, the very broad heading of black metal. Now, that genre has also broadened its breadth over the years, but distilled to its base essence is one of two things. In the modern sense, it's a specific stylistic thing, like let's sound like Bathory. But in the original 80s sense, it's just songs about Satan, like Merciful Fate or Venom or Bathory, Coven, Black Widow, and a few songs off Manowar's Hail to England are somehow considered all in the same genre, which obviously they're not. But you don't really fall under either of those headings. So beyond the corpse paint in the early days, do you see yourselves as being or having ever really been a black metal band?
Well, actually, we don't care. Back in the 90s, because when we started the band, the scene was full of death metal bands and grindcore bands, and most of the people hated the thrash metal from the 80s.
Right.
So when the black metal bands from...
That's okay.
Well, the black metal band from Norway started playing. The black metal meant a resurrection of the thrash metal from the 80s, more or less. In that sense, we were a black metal band because, you know, we were totally into thrash metal from the 80s. So if you have to sing about Satan, we never have been black metal band. But if, you know, if you need a sympathy for the 80s thrash metal to be black metal band, we definitely are. So it's just a matter of the definition, I think.
Okay, so it's more of a sound stylistic thing as opposed to a belief system or belonging to that kind of a... Because obviously black metal gets rather hardcore with that in some cases.
Yeah, and also, if you have to categorize our sound, probably black metal should be the closest because... Now it's almost anything goes in black metal, you know.
Right.
So yeah, probably black metal should be the word that's our style the best.
But given that term, you know, just saying black metal per se, do you really believe in the existence of the devil, either as a personal being or as a magical force that steers events in the world and which can be tapped into for destructive purposes? Or is it just totally a stylistic thing that you're tapping into?
Actually, I don't believe in anything like that. I don't believe in Satan, God, ghost or anything. I don't know. I want to believe, of course, if ghosts exist, that would be great. You know, if there would be something after your death. Unfortunately, I still can't believe it. I haven't seen any proof that makes me believe that kind of existence, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, because Japan has always been rather odd about metaphysics. You know, they adopted Buddhism from India and Catholicism from the Jesuits, but it always seemed to be more Shinto, if not completely rational and materialistic as a nation. So outside of some traditional mythology, what do you feel you're tapping into on that end in terms of black metal and the metaphysical spiritual element, if anything?
In the early days, we sang about some, you know, Japanese occultic stuff, but not anymore these days.
Right, because you certainly are a dark metal band, and there's this ongoing theme that you go through the albums over the years of suicide and tormented souls and death running through your oath. But, you know, again, I'm not really getting that, and I had to ask. I had to see exactly where you stood with this philosophically.
You're right, but most of the songs, the lyrics I wrote are about the fact of this world, you know, just dark side of the world, you know, like the death or, you know, torment. It's all, you know, the reality, yeah.
And that's kind of where I was picking up. So another thing that's interesting is that despite Satoshi sort of bouncing around the instruments there as the original guitarist, and then as drummer, and more recently as bassist as well. And, of course, the invaluable addition of Dr. McCannibal a few years back. Psy has always been the same three guys. You know, you never really change members. in today's music scene, that's incredibly rare.
You think so? We added the drummer and Dr. McCannibal, but still, you know, the original three members are in the band. I think that because we trust each other. I mainly handle everything, but I trust them, and they trust me too. I think that is very important.
So let's take this one album at a time, because you have a very rich back catalog. Scorn Defeat is still one of my favorite Psy records. I know you have some feelings about that otherwise. The cover to the version I have is awesome. It's the one with Shinichi and the katana and the skull and the flames springing from his hand, the foggy swamp. Where was this photo taken? You know, we don't tend to associate Japan with swampland over here.
Yeah, it was the place called Blood Washing Pond, called Chiarai no Ike in Japanese. There's a legend that they washed the blood away from the sword after they cut off the head of the criminals. So, yeah, it's a very atmospheric place. But just the other day, I found out it was just a legend.
Oh, it's too bad. It sounds good.
I grew up in the place close to that pond, so I used to believe it 100%. So it's very atmospheric, and even there is a sign about the blood-washing pond that explains the episode. But I went over the internet and found out it was just a legend. It was just a pond made by some student. It's all made up.
So whatever happened to your performing in that cloak he used to be in the beginning?
In the what?
In that cloak you used to wear in the early days.
Oh,
cloak. Oh, you mean the robe?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I still have it. I even wore the second robe, which is in the photo of the Infidel Arch, this gig in March. Because we played the Scorn Defeat 20th anniversary gig in this March, and I was wearing the robe again.
It's good to know that's still around.
Yeah, I never threw away anything. So
how did you get involved with Euronymous? Because if you weren't his first signing, Psy was certainly an early one signed on Death Like Silence.
When we got this Heavenly GP, Requiem for Fools, for Wild West Records, we sent out demos to as many labels as possible. And Euronymous was the only one who wrote back, because, you know, the Requiem for Fools was heavily influenced by Thrash Metal. And back then, nobody was interested in it except Euronymous. Yeah, and actually, I sent the demo to Dead, not Euronymous, but it was Euronymous who wrote back because Dead killed himself.
You were marked by a unique sound even then, with a very atmospheric and actually evil atmosphere, reminiscent of Eastern European acts like Master's Hammer or Cult de Ghouls or Tormentor. So tell us about, you just mentioned the 20th anniversary. Tell us about the 20th anniversary reissue with the bonus tracks. I mean, obviously it saved everyone from struggling to hunt down some reasonably hard-to-find EPs like the split with Kaweer and Requiem for Fools, which predates Scorn Defeat.
Well, actually, I'm not sure, but Scorn Defeat already has maybe 10 versions with different bonus tracks, like, you know, 3 LP version, double CD version in the U.S., Brazilian version with a Venom tribute track, so I don't know, maybe. And most of the materials, like the split EP with Cowell and all those stuff, are on these CDs. So probably now it's difficult to have the Die Hard version anymore. So
you'd mentioned possibly doing a Scorn Defeat Part 2 in the future?
I don't think so, because I don't think we can reproduce the atmosphere of Scorn Defeat anymore. I think it's kind of magical. This is the first album, and we didn't know anything about music. We didn't know anything about recording. So I think it's very primitive, and technically we can play much better.
Oh, yeah.
But if we re-recorded the album, I think the atmosphere would disappear. I don't think we can capture that atmosphere anymore again. So that is a very special album.
That's true, because there is something special about it. I have the second pressing version, obviously, from Death Like Silence, given the cover. And I understand this one's also become something of a rarity. So obviously, with the whole murder situation, you were forced to find a new label. What led you to Cacophonous for the next three albums? Because that label's somewhat limited distribution made those albums even more difficult to track down for many years than Scorn Defeat was.
Yeah, after Euronymous' murder, we had to choose Candlelight or Cacophonous. But Cacophonous was much quicker in answering our letters and faxes back then. So we chose Cacophonous, which was a huge mistake. They were horrible. They are still horrible. They still claim to the rights to the albums. So we cannot re-release those albums officially. It's just really difficult.
That's why it's been so hard. Now, Infidel Art, this one is also up there as a favorite of mine. You got Azuna and Zombie Terror, Suicidogenic. You got this awesome traditional artwork, Psy's label Terror and Funeral. You know, how can you go wrong with this? So was this an actual watercolor print you used, or was it just commissioned in that style? Because it's very believable and extremely aesthetic.
Yeah, it's a traditional drawing. I saw it on one of the exhibitions I attended, and it was very beautiful. And if you look into it, it looks scary at the same time. So I just searched for the book which had it and used it.
Yeah, because that's what I was saying. It really looks traditional, and it's very aesthetic. It's got a lot of atmosphere to it. Ghastly Funeral Theater, I noticed a strong emphasis on mellow piano coming to the fore, like almost like a Richard Clayton or Ferrante and Tetra with a bit of black metal thrown in for good measure. And once again, you got this awesome traditional artwork. So given the somewhat askew and non-traditional, even for Psy, focus of that album musically, is that the reason it was released as an EP, like Curse of Izanagi was more recently?
No. Actually, the Ghastly Funeral Theater was meant to be the split album with Abigail from Japan, but their labels didn't want that. So we had to release it as EP.
Okay.
Yeah, because it was going to be the split album with Abigail, it's very Japanese. Right. We try to make it as Japanese as possible.
They've got a very different sound than you, though, because the last time I'd heard them, they were more like a death thrash kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's quite different. After Infidel Art, we try to, you know, make some rock direction. Like, we try to, you know, we started taking in the influence from the rock from the 60s and 70s for the first time.
Right.
Career.
And that's actually where I'm going next. Hail Horror Hail is where things really started getting crazy. I mean, the title track has that section that sounds like 80s glam metal, complete with a Guitar Hero style solo. Then you have 4249, which has that awesome chorus, you know, I Stalk the Night, before it breaks into a little smooth jazz, and then it's back to like a Celtic Frost style thrash sound with some Rick Ross, Kerry King style whammy bar work. So it's just like all over the place. What is the symbolism of the song's title? What does 4249 represent?
Actually, it's very difficult to explain. 42 and 49, both are very sinister number in Japanese. Because 42 means like death, and 49 means death and torment. So people hate that numbers. Yeah, but it's kind of surrealistic things, because 42, 49, it has to be pronounced in Japanese. 42 is a very sinister word, only read in Japanese. But it means nothing if you read it in English. It's just a symbol of death and torment, but the title is in English, so, you know, some kind of a...
It loses some of that impact of the whole analogy. You actually tap into jazz quite a bit dating from this record forward. You get that little sax bit in 12 Souls, for instance. It's not the level of what Mika would eventually bring to the table, but still, it's not what most people would expect from metal, much less extreme metal. The power of the genre traditionally tends to be a lot more simple than the material that you're putting out there. Mm. Which brings us to another point, which I touched on the outset. Psy is always, even right from the start, was going to feed being extremely edgy and experimental by nature. You know, you're something of a syncretist, bringing together diverse musical influences, classical, jazz, rock, traditional metal, thrash, death, black metal. So where is this all coming from?
Well, I think the biggest reason is that I'm the keyboardist, not a guitarist. And I have two big musical background. One is, of course, thrash metal and heavy metal from the 80s. And another is classical music, because I was taking a classical piano lesson for almost 20 years when I was younger. So classical music is a huge, you know, background of mine, you know, musical background of mine. And after that, as I am a keyboardist, I started to delve into the varied style of keyboard. Because heavy metal is not a genre where the keyboard is often used for. So, you know, if you want to learn about keyboards and piano, you should learn classical music or jazz. Probably those two are the biggest category where keyboards are, the things are advanced.
Yeah, because even beyond those genres I mentioned, in The Dead Sing you include Buddhist chant, and in that song, An Invitation to Die as well, you seem to be tapping into Italian soundtrack territory like Morricone, and there's even a bit of latter period Beatles in Seed of Eternity.
And
then you have this sort of Charles Ives thing where you play them against each other, key against key, layering on top of each other at times. It's not even like you're modulating from one musical style or key to another in the course of a song, which the brain can adapt to easily. You have this tendency to throw several styles and types of instrumentation together all at once. So to agree, you're bringing a certain measure of sensory overload to the listener.
I always wanted to make some scary songs, and I came across John Zorn.
Right.
And I also analyzed a lot of horror movie soundtracks, and I came to the conclusion that that kind of, you know, just cut-up style and some avant-garde music from the 20th century fits the horror movie the best. Because it's very natural to use the cut-up style in horror movies. It's nothing unnatural if you listen to the song, you know, listen to that kind of music to the horror movie. Because when the scene changes, the music changes too. So we wanted to take in, you know, that kind of atmosphere into our music.
Right. And that actually taps into exactly where I was going to go next, which was that, you know, we're not talking about, like, symphonic metal here. This isn't like Epica, for example. Even though you do throw in some John Williams-esque moments into the mix every now and again, it's very avant-garde. Like you were saying, it's almost hard to listen to at times. So who are your influences in classical or jazz? Because for me, I'm hearing Charles Ives, Ornette Coleman, maybe even Arnold Schoenberg. The piano plays against the orchestration, which plays against the band. It often approaches this kind of polytonal structure.
As far as classical music goes, it's like Debussy, Liszt, Schumann, and Olivier Messiaen, and John Cage, Stockhausen, and of course Schoenberg and Altenburg.
Right.
Like that.
That was actually funny because until you started going into John Cage and Stockhausen, it was very traditional. You're looking for romantic music at Debussy, you know, and then all of a sudden, there they come. So.
Yeah, right. And for jazz, Miles Davis, Sam Ra, John Zorn, Albert Eiler, you know, that kind of crazy stuff is
right.
Life.
Yeah, I'm a huge Miles fan through all his periods. So is that why your songs tend to run so long, because you want to jam so much material and so many ideas into each one?
Mm-hmm. Usually I pick up the best style to express the vision which I want to express with music. I just try to use the best style. So sometimes it is classical music, sometimes some distorted guitar. And a distorted guitar can describe the vision which, you know, the strings or brass cannot describe, and vice versa.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just the result of, you know, that kind of... I never mean to be varied or anything. I just pick up the best way to, you know, express the horrors.
Okay, because there's so much going on in the course of every single song. It's like, wow, you really, like, you must be consciously planning, okay, I've got to jam all this stuff in there somewhere, so let's try to piece these particular suites together. So I didn't mention the cover of Hail Horror Hail. I know it looks like a skull, but is that one of the famous pussy prints? Because it's that sort of a watercolor.
Yeah, it is another traditional one I found. This studies the drawing of the ghost.
Okay.
Of the woman.
Scenario 4, Dread Dreams. I was never quite sure what to make of this one, because there's some tracks that I really like Diabolic Suicide with that female backing chorus and the keyboard stings, but there were others that seemed different from the albums and the material surrounding it. So was there anything in particular going on in your life or influencing you around the time of this album that led to what seemed to be more of a experimental period for Psy?
Yeah, the biggest influence on that album should be Frank Zappa.
Really?
Yeah, it's just like We Are Only In It For Money by Frank Zappa. Yes, that is very catchy, but experimental at the same time. Because being experimental is easy. Being catchy is easy. But he made it, those two things, at the same time, which is very difficult.
Right.
Yes, we wanted to try it for that album.
Next up came Imaginary Sonicscape. And this album, again, was something different from the previous record and different from what came after it. You guys always seem to evolve and never really stagnate as a band. You know, I did really like that jazz section in the Sunset Song, but that sort of video game dance music bit at about 4 minutes, that really threw me. And then Ecstatic Transformation sounded like you were trying to do Cathedral or Trouble. And the one song I really liked on there was Bring Back the Dead, which crossed traditional metal with a sort of Visual K J-Rock sound. I was definitely hearing like Siam Shade or D Shade there in the choruses. And possibly, I may be making a stretch here, but even my all-time favorite Japanese band outside yourselves, Lunacy. You know, that alone makes this album worth looking into. Were you consciously tapping into that stuff?
Actually, I don't like any Visual K or that J-Rock stuff at all. I hate them. But we never try to sound Japanese, but I don't think we can escape it either, because we speak Japanese and we live in the, you know, this insular country.
Right.
And we live in our own culture. I think Japan has been pretty much Americanized, but still, you know, we speak and think with a Japanese language. So even if it's not intentional, I think that the music we compose sounds different from, you know, sounds different to the ears of the European or the American people.
Right.
So I think it's rather spontaneous. It's a very natural thing.
And what was the inspiration for the cover here? Because, again, it looked very traditional, like an old Buddhist print of Hell and the Devas. But given that there were exactly three heads, I had to wonder if it wasn't specifically created for you guys.
I actually, it was drawn by Stephen O'Malley, now in San Isidro. So we just told him the concept of the album, so we just wanted to do some very psychedelic, you know, artwork.
Right.
And that's what he came up with. So I'm not sure if there's any meaning behind the drawing, but it's, you know, it's very LSD and psychedelic stuff. So
it's true. It was also your first album for Century Media after a few albums on Cacophonous. So did you find any benefit to being on a bigger label now, or was it more the same since you obviously jumped ship again for Candlelight on the next album?
Well, Century Media was really nice, you know, the label. They're very professional. Cacophonous was horrible because they were small and they never, you know, keep their schedule or anything.
Right.
But Century Media is, you know, much bigger and they do their business strictly, you know. They're very good at business. So,
right.
Yeah, and then, of course, I think Imaginary Soundscape had a lot of advertisement in the many magazines and radio stations in Europe and both in Europe and in the U.S. So I think it was we had a good benefit by working with a bigger label like Century Media.
Right. But what made you jump ship again the next album?
Simply, they didn't like the next one. We recorded Gallows Gallery for Century Media, but they didn't like it because it didn't sound black metal at all.
Wow. Well, that's actually where I was going next is, you know, we have Gallows Gallery next, and I know a lot of people were taken aback by this album, which, like you were saying, was more of a straightforward progressive metal album with clean vocals and such. But me, I always really liked it, especially in A Drowse and Pale Monument. But the whole album's amazing. You know, it's definitely a direction you could have gone further in. So what was the thinking behind the change? Because it was a big one, if in nothing further than the uncharacteristic clean vocal style.
Yeah, actually, the biggest change back then was that we had a new drummer.
Right.
We recruited Junichi, and Satoshi became a bassist.
Right.
Satoshi, actually, he's a very good drummer, but he prefers to play the slower stuff. He's a huge Black Sabbath fan, and he worships Bill Ward.
Right.
He's really good at playing slower songs, but he didn't want to play the faster songs. But I wanted to play some, you know, up-tempo and some faster track like Gallows Gallery. So we decided to have a new drummer. And I'm sure Satoshi is a better bassist than I am. So we thought it was the best move to recruit a new drummer. And I concentrated on vocals and keyboards. And Satoshi plays the best bass. So, yeah, that is the first album with a new lineup. And the clean vocals, well, I don't know, we have been making album with only harsh vocals, so I thought it was it should be interesting to make an album with only clean vocals. No, I didn't want to make some, you know, mix of harsh, you know, clean. If we do that, it has to be all clean vocals.
Right. But there was a lot of brouhaha about this production, because I know that you put it out on Candlelight, and then there was a reworking on End Records with legendary death metal guitarist James Murphy producing. And then finally, last year, a small European label did another remaster. So what was the story here? Why did this album seem to require so much reworking?
The first one was released in, actually, Baphomet Records by Killjoy of Necrophagia in the U.S., and they are licensed to Candlelight in Europe.
Okay.
And Killjoy... Actually, he was the problem. So he first he tried to cut the cost. So someone's friend was doing mastering for hobby, just for hobby.
Right.
So I think he did the first mastering for free.
Wow.
Turned out to be horrible. Actually, the real first one was much worse. All the sound was distorted. So I said no and had them master it again. But the second mastering wasn't that great either. That is the first, you know, the version released on Baphomet Records.
Right.
And I said no again, but they didn't want to do it again because they had a deadline. And so that is the reason.
Okay. But, you know, they kept remastering over and over again, even after that, because then you got the one on End with James Murphy, and then you got this other one last year that I forget the label, I think we're in Holland.
In Finland, the Blood Music.
So what is going on? Why do they just keep remastering this? Does it actually get better to your ears, or is it more the same?
Well, to be honest, I don't care about sound quality at all, because I grew up with 80s, you know, thrash metal, so I love Venom, I love Bathory.
Right.
In the 80s, I never thought the sound was that bad. I just didn't care, and I don't care either.
Okay.
Why do you think that it got such, you know, the reaction that it did where, like you said, Century Media rejected it and it was kind of bouncing around like that? Was it just the fact that you changed vocal style or was there something going on?
I think probably the vocal was the biggest problem with them.
Wow. Because, again, like I said, I really like this album. And I should also note that listening to Silver Universe, among others, that Shinichi's quite a player. You know, I never really thought of him in terms of Shredder or Guitar Hero.
Wow.
He's always appeared to have taken the more quiet, supportive role. But when he really lets it rip, you notice.
I can say he's different. I don't think he's a good guitarist, but definitely he's different.
Listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guests, Dr. McCannimal and Mariah Kawashima of Psy. And I'll tell you about our next segment after this.
Tribulation, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Greetings, pathetic mortal scum. This is Chris from Gloriana, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
that's my evil wizard.
Wow, that was great. Can you do one in the pirate voice?
Sure, I could be Captain Chris from Aelstorm if you want that.
Sure.
All I do is put on fucking accents all day long. All right. Ahoy there, shipmates. This is Chris from Aelstorm, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Yar.
Well,
I hate myself.
No, that was great. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that.
Hi, this is James Murphy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Rick Ross from Massacre, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Brian Lawrence from Dream Death, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
In our next segment, we talk about the real-life Curse of Izanagi and a bit about Insomnophobia, only here on Third Eye Cinema. But first, two sides of the band. We'll be playing a recent track off Insomnophobia by the name of Purgatorium. And then, first, we have a slick, clean vocal song off of Gallows Gallery. This is In a Drowse.
I'm leaving back. Walking
What about Hangman's Hymn? Because I know you were proud of this one, and it seems to be something of a fan favorite. I know you do songs from it in concert fairly regularly, like Knee Devil, which topped some best metal songs of the decade chart last year. Personally, I think Inked in Blood and In Devil's Arms are much better tracks, but, you know, it's good to see you guys getting recognized regardless. It's interesting to see the way you did the vocals, how it lends itself to the sort of interplay that you have now with Mika. So was that all you on this album, Arai? Because I wouldn't have been surprised if you had told me that Mika debuted there uncredited.
No, it's all me. Mika just modeled in the Inner Sleep for Hangman's Hymn. So, yeah, all vocals were done by me.
Because you were already doing that kind of switching back and forth between the black metal, death metal vocals.
Yes, because I wanted to make some operatic album. I don't mean using some operatic soprano singing or anything. I just wanted to make some dramatic, very theatrical stuff, only with that kind of vocal changes and a lot of orchestration. And yeah, I did everything by myself.
Wow. You know, this album's also sort of the beginning of the new era of Psy, because you can draw a defining line between, say, the first four records as being one sound, the next three being sort of experimental, and then from here forward being like the new model Psy.
No, I don't think so. We always try to make an album which tops the previous albums. That is the only reason that our, you know, music style changes from album to album. So when we made Hangman's Hymn, after that, we never try to make Hangman's Hymn Part 2 if we cannot top Hangman's Hymn.
Right.
So naturally, we have to change direction.
But there's nothing deliberate behind this. It's just, okay, let's just keep progressing forward.
We never do that.
At this point, I should also note that you've been doing the Morbid Angel trick, where you have this anagram thing going on, only instead of working your way through the alphabet, you keep spelling out Psy with the first letter of every album title. So I'm looking forward to the next G album.
The things are rather slow, so it's been almost 1.5 and 2 years since we recorded Insomniaphobia, but I'm working on the new tracks, but it's not easy. No, I'm getting old. I can't resist anything. Almost two songs are done, roughly done, but still only two songs. And I don't know how long it would take me to do the whole album. So I don't want to make the album which does not top the last album, at least to my ears.
Right. And so, I got to say, you guys have obviously been doing a lot of touring, which has to kick into your time, too.
Yes. So this year, we go to Europe 4 times. So maybe after that, we concentrate on writing new tracks. But I'm not sure. I just have to wait for the inspiration.
Right. Now, around this time, a few things happened. You know, you got involved with longstanding death metal horror film aficionados Necrophagia for their Divine Art of Torture and Goblins Be Thine albums, playing alongside Tita Tani of Italian prog metal Actimonia, which features Claudio Simonetti of Goblin. So how did you get involved originally with Killjoy and Necrophagia? Was it just over the production?
Yeah, at first he emailed me via internet, because in the 90s, I had a website about 80s thrash metal, very, you know, underground thrash metal, and I wrote about Necrophagia. He saw it and emailed me and started our contact.
And more importantly, obviously, you met up with Dr. McCannibal herself, the future Mrs. Mika Kawashima. So here's where we pull you into the conversation finally, Mika.
Okay.
So the big question first, how did you guys meet? Did you see her performing with her earlier band first, or did that come later?
No, I've never seen Psy live. I've never heard Psy music before I joined this band. Yeah, he was looking for a model for Hangman's Hymn artwork, and then our mutual friend introduced me to Mirai, the model. That's how we met first time.
Because I understand that he actually saw your old band playing, and that's how he knew that he could pull you in.
Yeah, I was in a death metal band, and I told him that I was in a band, and I asked him if he could see me live. And then he actually came, and he really liked the way I perform.
Yeah, first he gave me the demo.
Oh, yeah,
demo,
right.
And to be honest, I never expected anything, you know. It's like, I thought it could be another...
Yeah, one of
the... Yeah, amateur hobby band.
Right.
But I was totally blown away her vocals, to be honest.
Right.
So I decided to go see live.
So, Mika, you actually have a scientific degree, a PhD in physics. So, first of all, is your field more applied physics or theoretical?
Well, it's changing. I mean, I started out from fundamental physics, but now as a career, I'm doing more applied physics because that's so easier to get money from the government now. Yeah, that's the only reason.
Okay, because I was figuring, you know, if you came in as theoretical physics, then you're quite a deep thinker. And I was going to say, welcome to the club. Let's talk about the intersection of eschatology and the postmillennial zeitgeist for a bit. But seriously, given your background, what leads you to sing originally in this death metal band and then what can probably be described as a black metal band with Psy?
Well, it's a tough question. I've never been into black metal at all. I never liked black metal. I first of all grew up listening to hard rock material like Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, and some of LA metal things like Motley Crue. And then I moved to the U.S. because I went to high school there. That's 1992 or something. And I started listening to death metal from Florida, like Cannibal Corpse and stuff like that.
Right.
That's about it. And after I came back to Japan, I started doing a death metal band, and that's when I met Mirai.
Okay, because, you know, it's quite a jump. When I tell people that you're a theoretical physicist, they're like, what, really? Singing in a black metal band? In the way. So,
I like both science and music. Well, when I was young, 4 or 5 years old, I started learning electric organ. And, yeah, that's why I know how to play keyboard. And when I'm junior high, when I was 12 years old, I started playing saxophone. So that's my musical background, yeah.
Is it really true about your diet? You know, do you really eat grubs and bugs and worms? Or is that just a really strange promotional gimmick? And if so, why?
Not gimmick.
It's true, yeah, I do. Well, it's getting less and less these days. You know, I try to be pregnant and everything, so I try to be normal in diet, but I...
Take it from me, trying to be normal never works.
But it's not a gimmick, it's true, all true.
So what leads you to do that? What made you say, you know what, I think I want to eat grubs and worms? And
Well, I thought it's very disgusting thing to eat bugs and, you know, cockroaches and stuff. When I saw it on the internet, I saw a weblog, someone's doing it as a professional. He's doing it as a job. And he had a bug eating party in Tokyo, and I somehow wanted to attend it for curiosity. And I asked Mirai to go there with me.
Yeah, she forced me to try it.
And yeah, we both tried it, and the bugs are delicious.
Yeah, true. They're delicious.
Yeah,
true.
They're good.
Wow.
Yeah, they're all cooked professionally, and it was, you know, served in a right way. So they're all delicious. So I started cooking bugs at home, and I found some good thing about eating bugs.
Well, you know, obviously there's protein in them.
Protein, yeah, protein, calcium, and yeah, that's the reason.
So do you actually, like, go out in the yard and try to catch these, or do you buy them from a service, or?
I buy them on the internet.
Wow.
And I actually, I keep them at home.
Oh, you grow them, you raise them.
Yeah, I grow them, yeah.
Okay. So another thing that's fascinating is that not only are you a female doing death metal vocals, which until fairly recently wasn't all that common, but that, as you mentioned, you're an accomplished saxophonist. Now, I know Mariah had brought in some studio players to do sax here and there over the years, but it's not the same. You know, like most studio musicians, there's enough technique to do the job, but no real soul. You know, you're something else. And, you know, if Mariah doesn't mind me pointing it out, of course, you're drop-dead gorgeous. You know, looks, brains, talent, and into extreme metal. You're quite the catch. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention your apparent propensity for recording topless. I know a lot of guys wish they were there for a Psy recording session, myself included.
Yeah, but that's true, too. I do recording topless.
So, seriously, what is that all about? Do you really feel that constricted by clothing that it opens up your lungs and ribcage that much to be half naked?
Well, I feel comfortable that way. It's, you know, being naked is not anything special for me, because especially during the summertime, I think a lot of people do that, but when I get home, I get naked.
Right.
So it's just the same thing. You know, it's more comfortable.
Oh, fly me over. I'm coming to the next recording session. One album I really enjoyed, and I know Mika doesn't agree with me on this one, but the tribute to Venom, which I believe was her debut with Psy. I usually don't get too excited about tribute albums. You know, the originals are almost always so much better, and I'd rather hear bands doing their own material than a cover. But in this case, the band covering the material leaps and bounds over the band being covered. I mean, Venom were hardly noted for their refined musicianship and their broad palette.
Yeah, I don't know how people thought about Venom tribute, but 100% I agree with you. I never liked the cover version better, so I don't know. I have no comment on this.
I have to ask, Frank Zappa, was he an influence at all? Because when I think about this particular period in Psy's history, it springs to mind just how good the members of Psy have to be switching seamlessly from one style to the next in the course of a single track. It's like how Zappa used to recruit some rather advanced players from the world of jazz, fusion, and classical to play with him, because even when he was doing some asinine track like Truck Driver Divorce or Penis Dimension, the music was complex and difficult to follow. You know, it requires an advanced level of skill to perform.
To be honest, I don't think our music, Psy's music, is not that difficult to play. We're not a technical player. Maybe it didn't sound. I don't know. I always think if you listen to some complicated songs, oh, this should be very difficult to play. But composing, if you compose it, it's very easy to play. You have you can have a score, exactly know how the major is, how the bar is set. So it usually music is not as difficult
as
play.
It sounds, right?
As it sounds.
True. My favorite, speaking of this EP, is Teacher's Pet. You know, I love hearing Nika on the opening of the track. Your voice and accent are so much sexier than the girl in the Venom version. You know, what Venom did have going for them was the punk vibe, you know, the energy that they buried under this mountain of sludge from not being smart enough to tune their guitars or whatever. I mean, it's really appreciated to hear somebody that knows what they're doing covering a band that's basically as simple and primal as that and making something special out of it. So, again, this is definitely an album I really love. Now, we come to your final album with End Records, which was Scenes from Hell. Prelude for the Oracle, whose video was the world at large's first view, lovely Dr. McCampbell. Did the video do well for you in the Scenes from Hell album? Because I believe this is also the first side video, period.
Well.
It's not easy to give a comment on that video.
No comment. It's okay.
It's okay, but it's totally different from the visions of Scenes from Hell.
So I didn't follow what you had in mind for the song and the album, is what you're saying.
No. we asked the director to remake it, but we didn't see any improvement, so we kind of gave up.
Okay.
That's the story.
All right.
You know,
opening a can of worms here. But you know, it's quite a challenging song to expect the average listener flipping around YouTube or what have you to get into. You know, there's a lot going on there, especially with that odd sort of mariachi horn section you were using all over this album.
Well, I don't know. But personally, I never thought the songs from Scenes from Hell are very challenging. I thought people would think those songs are rather accessible and straightforward, but I was wrong.
Well, that just shows how far out you are, because it's like, oh yeah, this is going to be normal, everybody will catch this one, and people are like, what? Now, I know there was a lot of talk going on about Musica and Tempora Bella, and I half expected to see another video for that song, but it never materialized. So was there any reason? Was it just the video experience just didn't work out for you, so you just let it be?
Because always difficult to find the proper director, because of course there are always the problem of budget. It's not easy to make video. It's
right.
More difficult than making music. So
the track itself, there's some nice sax late in the track, because all of a sudden it takes this detour into that sort of 80s Silk Stockings, Glenn Frey territory, You Belong to the City and all that. And every time I hear that sort of sexy sax playing that Nika's so damn good at, I keep picturing like blinds being drawn and people taking off their clothes. Which may be appropriate, considering.
Yeah.
Another favorite on this album is Vanitas. You know, you've got another nice Shinichi solo, and all that back and forth between the two of you vocally, it's chaotic and crazy, but it's very high energy and almost punk in that respect. So were you pulling that from, you know, you just came out of the Venom sessions and now you're doing this?
I don't know.
Jeez. Does it?
I don't really think about it. I just do it and it came out that way. So
fair enough.
It's a natural thing. And it's recorded at two different places. It's not recorded at the same place.
Oh, so you were recording at a different time than Mariah was recording?
Yes.
Wow, that's a nice mix that you did to pull it together like that. One thing that I like about your voice is that while it's clearly the throaty growl of death metal, it's very obviously a young woman behind those tones. You know, it's not something frighteningly androgynous like Angela Gossow. I'm not sure what she's trying to get at there, though I do like Arch Enemy as a band.
Well, I don't think I never said it in an interview or anything, but I used to be in a copy band of Arch Enemy.
Really?
I never told you before. Well, it's not like I formed the band for a long time, a year or anything. It's just like a project thing. it's not the way I'm trying to be or anything, but well, thanks to Angela Gossel, because, well, I was doing, you know, death metal growl stuff as a hobby, but since she joined the band, she started doing the death metal vocals. You know, people are more
receptive.
Yeah, acceptable for female death metal vocals.
Right.
So.
But my point was that, you know, I can still tell that even though it is this kind of powerful vocal, that it's a woman doing it. Whereas Angela, it's like, you can't tell. And it's kind of creepy in a way. So I do appreciate that. It's like, okay, I still know who you are as opposed to, On the album here, Mariah, what was with this sort of Russian folk music influence you brought in that I tapped into before? Was it deliberate, like you were reading a lot of Ospensky, Blavatsky, and Valery Borisov, or did you just happen upon the sound?
It's not a Russian folk music. It's a Russian classical music.
Really?
Like, yeah, because there are a lot of great Russian classical composers who are not very famous, like Kalinnikov and that kind of stuff. I think they took in some Russian folk melodies into the classical music. Sound extremely cheesy, but I love them.
But, you know, I'd assume that if you had tapped into a pagan folk ethos, it would be from your native land, like the music from No Plays or what have you. So this was kind of a surprise.
I don't know why, but Russian folk music is very popular in Japan. I think there should be something close between Russian folk music and Japanese folk music. So there are a lot of famous Russian folk music here, which everybody knows in Japan.
Some of the bits of business you threw into the mix in this album were bitingly strange, like that keyboard sample horn section on L'Arthur Morir that sounds kind of like the ABC Wild World sports theme song. I keep getting flashes of football games whenever the song is playing.
And after Sins from Hell, I noticed that the perception towards the depressed sounds totally differ from country to country.
Really?
Yeah, I think this is... Japanese people mainly think about war, World War II, listening to that kind of brass section. So, it was like a military march kind of thing. But I was quite surprised. People from the U.S. or from Mexico or from Europe have no impression like that. So I think that was a big mistake, actually.
Well, you know, it depends. If you're into football, then that's what it brings to mind for us.
Yeah,
at least for me.
It was 100% war songs.
Wow.
But I didn't know it was just Japanese people.
So you then put out the Curse of Izanagi EP on another small label, Cult Records. It's another great traditional album cover and some interesting contents. You got a Venom cover, but it's not the same as on the Venom EP. An aggressive cover of your own song, Curse of Izanagi, off Hail Horror Hail. And two new tracks, one of which, War, is mostly spoken word. So what was this all about? You know, it's not bad for what's often considered to be a throwaway format, the EP format.
Actually, it's some kind of strange EP. It's not a new EP. All of the songs were already recorded in the past.
Right.
And there's some, you know, strange story about Curse of Izanagi. Curse of Izanagi was meant to be the bonus track for Scenes from Hell, Japanese pressing, Japanese version. But just before the album was out, the owner of the label killed himself.
Oof.
So the Japanese version didn't come out. After that, we planned to release The Curse of Izanagi as a 70 GP. But again, the label owner died.
Wow.
So I didn't feel very good about that song. But finally, I don't remember, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we went to Finland to play one show at some small festival, and they wanted to release some EP, you know, something like some EP. And actually, the label, one of the owners of the label is a Beheret guy.
Oh, okay.
So I thought it'd be okay. They never care about it. So I decided to include the Curse of Izanagi new version, and finally, it came out safe.
Right, I was going to say, it must have really had the Curse of Izanagi on it.
I don't believe in that kind of thing, but still, you know, it's kind of, you know,
right,
disturbing. So.
Now, you changed labels again to Candlelight for Insomnophobia, which is one of my very favorite Psy records. I know I keep saying that, but it's true. One big change, even over the Venom tribute and Scenes from Hell, is that Mika's now a major player in the overall sound. It was much more like a pinch hitter role before this record. Now she's all over it, vocally and with the sax. I have to say
that there's no contest here. My favorite track is Amnesia with that whole jazz keyboard section, CMT with a great blues solo, and then Mika comes in with that incredible sax part. You know, I've been known to just keep rewinding and listening to those parts over and over like a loop. It's that good.
Thank you.
Even so, Purgatorium with its great traditional metal guitar intro, Transfiguration Fear, which sounds like it's an outtake from Gallows Gallery, Somnophobia has some vocals from Mariah early in the track that sound like something off Scorn Defeat or Infidel Art. It's almost like you were touching all the bases of your past career, like, oh yeah, we can do this too. So were you actually going back and saying, all right, here's a little bit from this sound, and here's a little bit from that album?
I think so. I think I can say that is the nightmaric version of Imaginary Soundscape. So, yeah, I think you can hear some past sounds from, you know, Imaginary Soundscape and, of course, some Gallows Gallery, some Hair Horror Hell.
Right.
But
right.
Still, it is definitely the new album side.
And I have to assume that it's the concept album with the seven parts of Lucid Nightmares. You know, all I know is that it has to do with the dream state and getting lost out there somewhere. So tell us a little about what you were shooting for here conceptually.
I always love movies like Carnival of the Soul.
Right.
And like Others and Jacob's Ladder. Because right. Where the borders between dream and reality disappear. So I myself often have a lucid dreams, like in the dreams, I realize it's just a dream. So I wanted to create something like that musically. It is a fantasy. Fantasy is not a reality, but it's not a complete dream either. It's something between reality and dream. So I wanted to express that kind of feeling with music, you know, like you are going in and out of dreams.
Right. And you can actually feel that, too, that it's kind of drifting in and out of some tracks. And here comes something different. Oh, wait, there we go again. It's shifted somewhere else. And it is kind of like a dream logic. So you achieve what you set out to. There's so many great tracks here. You know, Fault of the Thrall, Equal, where you cribbed a bit of Fabio Frizzi. I'm not sure if it's the score for The Beyond or City of the Living Dead, but I recognized it right away. You know the part I'm talking about, right? That cover really fooled me. You know, I certainly would have assumed it was an actual decadent painting from the turn of the century. It's very Gustave Moreau, but it was actually a modern era guy you commissioned to do the cover.
Yeah, it is Adrian Cantor from Israel. Now he lives in Germany. He's a great artist. He did the cover for Scenes from Hell 2.
Which is completely different. So it says he can switch styles dramatically.
Yeah, but still you can tell that that's Adrian's work.
And regardless, this is a really great album. It's definitely recommended to those with adventurous musical tastes. I know that you've been touring a lot and doing shows around Japan, too. But have you started – well, okay, you already said you started some work towards the next album.
Yeah.
As I brought up earlier, I understand that after a few years as a couple, you're finally going legitimate and tying the knot. So, omedetou. What pushed you over the edge?
I don't know. We just are a perfect match.
I can hear that. From this interview, I can hear it. So, again, congratulations. You know, when I was younger, I was very anti-marriage, and I said I'd never do it. But if you meet the right person, I kind of surprised everybody when I got married. And, you know, well, living with another person isn't always a smooth ride. I can also say that I've been happy ever since. Now, of course, she's also Asian, so maybe that's the difference. But, again, congratulations and good luck to you on this. So, do you have any tour plans you want to mention? Yeah, will you be coming back to the States anytime soon?
We are playing in Germany and in Finland in July, but right now, unfortunately, we don't have a plan to come back to the U.S. We'd love to, but it's a little bit difficult for us because in Europe, there are so many festivals, so we can do some, you know, festival hopping.
Right.
But in the U.S., we only know Maryland
that well.
Yeah. Listen, if we have to tour the U.S. without losing money,
right,
we have
right.
to tour like, you know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks. It's pretty much difficult for us because five, you know, all of us have
day jobs.
So.
Right. Do you have anything you'd like to plug or do you want to point listeners to your website or your Facebook page?
Twitter and
Facebook page,
maybe web store. Where do they go to find side material?
Facebook or Twitter.
Well, with that, Mika and Mariah, I'd like to thank you both again for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema. It was truly a pleasure. And, you know, when you finally get that next album out, I'd love to have you back on.
Oh, thank you very much.
And hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, hope to talk to you. You're going to spread the word, too.
All right, so thank you again, and I was going to say you weren't assuming the side, but it's morning for you guys. So.
It's 12 p.m., so it's lunchtime for us.
Right, a little early for you to go to sleep. All
you.
Take care. And Mika and Mariah asked me to mention their Twitter, which is https://twitter.com/sidejapan. And they also are working on their 10th full-length album, which they're hoping to start recording sometime in the middle of 2014. They have 10 tracks almost done, and the title will be Grave Word. So to close out our interview with Mika and Mariah, we have another track off Insomnophobia, which we just discussed, and which is actually my all-time favorite side track. Stay tuned after the close for one final side classic, but right now, this is Lucid Nightmares 4, Amnesia.
Sam Rosenthal of Black Tip Flute. You're not recording this, are you? Okay, this is Sam Rosenthal of Black Tape for a Blue Girl, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, I'm Marcus Thomas. I'm the guitar player and vocalist for the Vladimirs and Sono Morte, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
This is Brian Day of the Vladimirs, Sono Morte, and any other metal band that you know that I have been a part of, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema, and you should continue to listen to this until your ears bleed.
Me too? Oh, okay. All right. I'm horrible at these things. Hey, I'm... Yeah, this ain't going to work. Hey, guys. I'll try it serious this time. All right. Hi, I'm crying. No, I'm sorry. I can't do it.
Hi, this is Udo Dorfstadter, the singer of UDO, and you listen to the show Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, this is Golf Minister. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
To put some echo on that.
Hey, this is Davey Vane from Vane. I want you to get very close to your speakers right now, right up against your speakers, because you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Mika Marai from Psy. Next time on Week 59 of Third Eye Cinema, Ace Still, vocalist from legendary black and doom metal act, Dope Lord. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Track from Psy, which finds them tapping into a more visual K musical vein. This is Bring Back the Dead. If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. See you in 2 weeks.